So my wife and I have five kids, and this week I was doing dishes because that's what you do when you have five kids. You have a lot of them. And our middlest, Hannah, who's like seven, right in the middle of it, she goes, "Dad, how long do you think you're going to be here?" And I was like, "You mean like, am I going anywhere?" And she's like, "No, I mean, how long are you going to be around?" And I was like, "What are you asking me?" She's like, "When are you going to die?" I was like, "I just turned 40, Hannah. Thanks a lot for speeding up this existential crisis that I've got." She's like, "I hope you stick around for a few years." I was like, "I do too." I don't know what your life is like these days, but you know, with the pandemic, a lot of us are asking these kinds of questions. A lot of us are facing our own mortality. And so we're in a series called Tomorrowland on heaven and hell and what comes next. And today we get to the most popular of subjects, hell. Because I'm convinced that there are two things we need to address today. One is a lot of us grew up hearing a lot about hell, and I know there's a lot of people who are terrified of this. There is not a less popular belief in the Christian faith than the idea of God's judgment. There's a famous atheist named Bertrand Russell who wrote a book a couple hundred years ago called Why I'm Not a Christian. And in it, this was his big reason. He did not like that Jesus talked so much about God's wrath. He actually said it was one of the great moral defects in Jesus' character, that he talked so much about the judgment of God. And I appreciate his honesty that he would say that, because one of the problems that the Christian faith is facing in the West today is that Jesus' people talk less about God's judgment or in different ways about God's judgment than Jesus did. And by the way, I get it. Having, you know, preaching on this, is it, talking about this, it's not polite dinner conversation. And sometimes we're the problem. The people of God talk about God's judgment and hell. And sometimes we can come across like we know everybody who's going, and it's the people we don't like. So I bet you almost everybody in this room have seen pictures of these people. There's Westboro Baptist Church. There's a handful of people that go around to different events that are incredibly polarizing, like funerals of dead soldiers, and they hold signs up saying that they know who, that all the people who are going to that funeral are going to hell. That is what sometimes church people give the impression. We give the impression that we know who's going, and it's all the people we don't like. So with all that said, there's no escaping that in the Bible, God's judgment is coming. And it is in, if you believe the Christian story, we have to ask, why don't we talk about that? Or talk about, and why don't we talk about it the way we do, as if we're the judge, not God? And when, more to the point, this is, again, just for Christians now that I'm talking about, but when did we forget that throughout history, God's people have always known that God judging the world was a good thing, because God was going to set the world right, set us right, make things to the way they were always intended to be? When did we forget the good news of Jesus actually involves the good news of hell? And I mean that. Because hell is a word of hope. God is not a monster. All right, before we get into this, at the beginning of this series, I pointed out that if you were to search the Bible for verses that included the terms heaven and hell, or if you were to go to BibleGateway.com and search heaven and hell, you would find zero results, because there's no real verses that put heaven and hell in the same category. But if you were to search your Bible for the words heaven and earth, you would find almost 200 results, because hell is not the counterpoint to heaven. Earth is. Heaven and earth were made together, and God's dream is to bring them together, to reconcile them together. But that involves God judging the world, and that involves hell. So if we want a healthy understanding of hell, we need to ask the question, what is hell? Or maybe a better way to start that is, where is hell? Because you know, you can find hell on a map, at least the way Jesus talked about it. You can find hell on a map. This is MapQuest. This is a picture of what Jesus was talking about when Jesus was talking about hell. It's the word Gehenna. Let me hear you say Gehenna. That means Valley of Henna. And that, it's right outside of Jerusalem. When I was in Jerusalem, we walked, some of y'all have been to Jerusalem. You've walked past this. It's a valley that would have been associated with the idolatry. It was outside of Jerusalem. And Israel, would, when in their darker moments, they would go to that valley to worship other gods, gods like Baal and Molech. It was the cheap hotel where Israel cheated on her relationship with God with other lovers. But it's not just that it was associated with idolatry. It was the kind of idol worship that Israel was doing. So I'm going to give you a few verses. You might want to write these down because these are very enlightening. 2 Chronicles 33:6, 2 Kings 23:10, and Jeremiah 32:35. Here's what I want you all to see in these verses. Look at what the Gehenna is described as. Look at this, if you could put that up. They built high places for the Baal in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, which is Gehenna, to sacrifice their sons and daughters to Molech. Though I never commanded it, this is God, I never commanded them to sacrifice their sons and daughters, nor did it enter my mind that they should do such a detestable thing and make Judah sin. All right, 2 Chronicles. He sacrificed his children in the fire in the valley of Gehenna, practiced divination and witchcraft, and sought omens and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger. Or when King Josiah in 2 Kings is doing reform, you know what one of the first things he does? He gets rid of the altars in Gehenna, if you could put that up. He desecrated, Josiah desecrated Topheth, which was in the valley of Gehenna, so that no one could use it to sacrifice their sons or daughters in the fire to Molech. Molech was a god that demanded child sacrifice. Here's what I want you to see. When Jesus talks about Gehenna, when he talks about hell, he's talking about a place that every Jew listening would have known that was associated with child sacrifice. And that was never something that God wanted. And it made God angry. One of the big things I think that we miss out on when we talk about, when we understand what Jesus is talking about, hell, would have been what is the most obvious to the first century listening to Jesus. And that's that hell was outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem has a meaning. It means the shalom of God. Shalom, where everything, peace, where everything is in right relationship with God and with each other. Gehenna is outside of that. Jerusalem is where God, is where things are the way God intends them to be. Gehenna is outside of that. And here's the thing that really got the prophets and Jesus, or the God, ticked off. The people who sacrificed their children in the day in Gehenna to those other gods that they were cheating on the true God with, those people would come back, they would sacrifice their children, and then they would come back in the city of Jerusalem to sleep at night. And notice something else. The fires of Gehenna are lit by human hands, not God's. Later on, Jesus' brother James is going to write a letter in the New Testament, and he's going to talk about the destructive power of our words when we gossip. And he's going to say, you know, the tongue is a fire that can, it can start a fire that spreads like wildfire. But he actually says the fire comes from hell. We are the ones who let hell into God's good world. In the example James gives, hell doesn't come through God. It comes through us. Yes, hell is cruel, but to blame the cruelty of hell on God is like an alcoholic blaming sobriety for the pain of his addiction. This is a big point. People will go to hell because they choose to go there. So why would anyone choose this? There is no righteousness or holiness in hell, but it does alter, it gives the alternative of self-righteousness. It offers no joy or real happiness, but it does offer some sense of satisfaction and holding on to grudges and bitterness and resentment and hurt. There's no real fulfillment, but it does offer the illusion of winning and getting your own way. Now does hell start to make a little more sense? Does it make sense with our own hearts and with our experience with humans? I mean, we've all seen marriages shatters, or families explode, or addictions destroy people, or anger that blossoms into rage. And we've all felt that pride in our own heart that no one can tell me what to do. And in our darker moments, who in this room, who watching, would say they've never had moments where they're like, I am the master of my own fate. I am the captain of my soul. In our darker moments, we're able to admit we have made ourselves our own God. And the door to the human heart always opens from the inside. God is gentle. Yes, he is the hound of heaven. He's always searching, always trying to compel us to choose joy, but he will not force goodness on us. Now, that may sound different than the caricature of hell that you have heard throughout, you know, the decades of your life. But listen, I think this is what the majority of Christians have believed throughout the majority of history. And yes, there was a few centuries where the Catholic Church got sideways and used a more medieval picture of hell, but this is, I think, more true to the scriptures what we're talking about. We are having to choose every day of our life what kind of person we are going to be forever. C.S. Lewis was a great Christian and thinker who was for a while an atheist before he worked his way back towards the Christian faith. And one of the things that was the most challenging for him was Jesus' insistence on hell, because Jesus talked about hell. And towards the end of his... Okay, how's that? All right, sorry everyone online. So C.S. Lewis was he realized that every day we're deciding what kind of person we are going to be. And I want to read you this quote, even though it's long, because I think it's insightful. He says, "Taking your life as a whole, all of your life, you are slowly turning towards the central thing, the part of you that chooses either into a heavenly creature or into a hellish creature, either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or else one that is in a state of war and hatred with God and with its fellow creature and with itself." This is why Jesus, before people decide to follow him, warns people to count the cost before becoming Christians, because make no mistake, Jesus says, if you let me, I will make you perfect. The moment you put yourself into my hands, that is what you're in for. Nothing less or other than that. You have free will. I would say when you are baptized, that's what Jesus is saying to you. If you have free will, you can choose to push me away. But if you do not push me away, understand I am going to see the job through. Whatever suffering it may cost you in your earthly life, whatever inconceivable purification it may cost you after death, whatever it costs me, I will never rest nor let you rest until you are literally perfect, until my Father can say without reservation that he is well pleased with you as he has said he was well pleased with me. This I can do and will do, but I will not do anything less. This is what Jesus is offering. He can make us into the kind of people who fit in the age to come. Do you realize that we are going to have to stand before the unrestrained fullness of God? Do you realize that is when you are baptized, you receive the Holy Spirit? And that's not just church words. That means God is living inside of you, chiseling away, trying to help us become the kind of person who can stand before God. You are opening yourself up to the life of Jesus being formed in you. And listen, we love to preach about how heaven is a place where there will be no more tears and no more suffering. But who causes the tears and suffering now? Is it not us? Aren't we the ones who cause the crying? I mean, I think just personally, how often my own acts of selfishness have caused other people to cry. If God takes me into heaven as I am, I will undoubtedly cause crying again. No more tears in heaven means no more Jonathan Storments in heaven. Now, to be clear, I plan on going to heaven. I want to be a part. I want to be with God forever, but I know God has work to do on me. The Holy Spirit has work to do on you, on all of us, because the world the way it is not the way it will always be. I know that for some of us, we've had glimpses of heaven as we, you know, go to the Grand Canyon or stand on Pinnacle Mountain or whatever it is, but this world has shown us plenty of glimpses of hell as well. There's a great theologian, a guy named Miroslav Volf, who grew up in Croatia during the genocide. And he said that watching friends and family being murdered in front of them, the only way to keep from going insane was to realize there is a God who was angry about what was happening and would one day restore justice. And he said, if God, he came to America and he was so frustrated with the way people talked about or did not talk about the judgment of God. He said, if God does not possess the ability to feel wrath, what happens in the human heart is you have this insatiable desire for vengeance. He said, the only way for me to put down the sword in my own hand was to remember that there is a good and loving God who has the sword in his. And then he came to America and he was so frustrated because he heard preachers and theology professors and they would talk about God's love and grace, which is rightfully so, but they neglected the part of judgment and they didn't talk about hell. He said we were naive because we hadn't seen things like genocide. And then he went on to say this. So my argument, I get my argument's not popular with people in the West, but imagine speaking to people as I have, whose cities and villages have been first plundered and then burned and leveled to the ground. It takes the quiet of a suburb for the birth of the idea that human nonviolence or being able to turn the other cheek is a result of a God who refuses to judge. In a scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent, that idea will invariably die like other pleasant captivities of the liberal mind. If God were not angry at injustice and deception, it did not make a final end of violence, that God would not be worthy of our worship. Listen, I know some of you here, or maybe some of you watching, may think, this is what's wrong with church people. This is what's wrong with people who believe in God. And maybe you don't believe in God, but listen, in your bones, no matter what you do or do not believe, you want this to be true. How many of y'all have watched the show Breaking Bad? All right. I love the half. There was a few people in the back who were very proud of their... Yeah, I have too. I've watched Breaking Bad. I don't recommend it. It is an incredibly dark show. It's a very profound show. But here's what it's about. It starts off with this Walter White guy who's a high school chemistry teacher, and he finds out he has cancer. And so he realizes he's leaving his family in an unstable financial position, and he realizes one of the things he knows how to do is chemistry, so he can start making meth. And that's his first step. And towards the end of the show, he's not only a person who makes meth, he is a full-blown drug empire overlord. He's murdered many people cruelly, sometimes his own family, the very family he set out to try to help, he has absolutely destroyed. And I don't want to give away the ending of the show for you in case you're interested, but I will tell you this. Vince Gilligan, the guy who made Breaking Bad, he made it because he said he was tired of watching a generation grow up thinking there are no consequences to decisions. He said he was tired of watching a world make decisions without having to realize that affects other people. He said it galled him to no end, that he felt this need for justice. He actually used the word. He said, and this is him not as a believer, he said, I felt the need for some kind of biblical atonement. And then he went on to say, I don't believe in heaven, but I can't not believe in hell. We want this story to be true. Everybody, no matter what you do or don't believe, this story is at its core of a good king returning to establish his redemptive kingdom and kick out the oppressive, enslaving powers that have hurt people for too long. This is the stuff of fairy tales. It's the stuff of novels and blockbuster movies. It's the stuff of hope. And an atheist lawyer may argue with the idea of hell, but then enforce the logic of hell by trying to fight to keep child abusers and Bernie Madoff off the streets. By his action, he's showing the biblical logic of hell, that for our world to flourish, there are certain forces that must be kept at bay. People don't like hell. I get it. People don't like hell, but they dream of a world without evil. I mean, I've never met a fan of genocide or human trafficking. Every beauty queen, you know, dreams of world peace. The problem is we are not beauty queens. And even our beauty queens aren't beauty queens. To be sure, this is good news for our world. God is going to kick the human trafficking and the genocide out of it. But here's the problem. He's more serious about it than we are. I think one of the biggest problems in American churches is that we do not know the depths of our own sin. Maybe the biggest problem in America is that we do not know the depths of our own sin. God is more serious about this than we are. And the spark that sets the wildfire loose in our families and in our cities and in our churches lives in me. The root of the poison tree is in me. The problem is in us. It is no secret that religion can make people better. But for every Martin Luther King Jr. or Mother Teresa or Randy Hughes or David Smith, notice I intentionally left Linda Smith out of that. For every person that was God is, you know, eventually making a saint, there's also a KKK Grand Dragon or a Fred Phelps, the Westboro Baptist Church leader, certain that God hates all the same people they do. And that's why I want to talk about hell, because Jesus talks about it a lot, but not like we do, and rarely to the same people we do. Okay, there's a famous preacher a couple hundred years ago, a guy named Jonathan Edwards, who wrote a sermon that is incredibly well known, at least the title, called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. How many of y'all have heard of that sermon? Okay, I hated that sermon. I'd never read that sermon. And then I read it and I realized, you know who he's talking to? He is not some street preacher yelling at the side on a sidewalk somewhere. He's preaching that in a church to church people. He was talking to the church because the sinners in the hands of an angry God were the people who bore his name. This is what I mean with, I believe almost all the problems in the world and all the problems in church and a lot of the problems in the world could be solved if the people of God sat quietly and considered themselves before God. I am now talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not the God we construct in our own mind who likes puppies and everything we do. I'm talking about the real living God, that if we would let the piercing gaze of God cut through all our pretenses, if we let ourselves feel both the grace and judgment of God, I think that would change the way we lived. Now, being judged by God doesn't sound fun, but it is what every person in this room, every person's soul is hungry for. We all have this sense something's is off with us, right? We all have this sense that if we were weighed, we would be found wanting. And while the world has abandoned the ancient categories of sin and salvation, we're still all searching for the same thing, the love of God. And that's the thing about God's judgment. It is never divorced from the love of God. Listen, we love to talk about grace, but grace is an indictment. It's forgiveness of something that has been done that is wrong. Before it's anything else, it's saying, I have fallen short and I need mercy. The problem comes when Christians talk about the judgment of God without reflecting on the love that the judgment of God is based in. That's when we start drawing lines of who's in and who's out and feeling a little bit smug and happy about being on the right side of that line. But the Bible talks about judgment in the age to come in surprising ways. Jesus talks about it in surprising ways. Okay, I hope you have your Bible, because now with all that in the background, we're going to get to Jesus. In Matthew chapter 8, turn, if you have your Bible, to Matthew chapter 8. But before we get there, I want to show you, Jesus ends the Sermon on the Mount, his most famous sermon, in surprising ways. He's talking about how a wise person builds their house on a rock and a foolish person builds their house on sand. And by the way, they both look like houses. They're standing until the storm comes. And then all of a sudden you realize who was wise and who was foolish. And right before he tells that story, Jesus says this. Listen, he talks about watching out for true and false prophets. And then he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and in your name perform many miracles? God, on that day, did we not go to Bible class? God, did we not teach Bible class? We were on the nursery roll for decades. God, I got my minor in Bible from that university. God, I got my major in Bible from that university. And Jesus says, on that day, he will cut through all the pretense and tell them plainly, I never knew you. What are you talking about, Jesus? You're like offending the people that are on your team here, man. Well, this is what he's talking about. The very next chapter, in verse 5, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him. All right, full stop. You know the racial tension that we're feeling as a country right now? It's nothing compared to what Jews would. This is a gospel written to Jews. Matthew's a gospel written to Jews. It's nothing to what they would feel when they hear the word centurion. For decades, Rome has had their boot on their necks, and the centurions were the ones who made sure that boot was firm. And now, the centurion comes to Jesus for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? And the centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. And I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment. Here's one of the things I want you to see. Judgment in this story is directed primarily at the people of God, not at outsiders. Jesus, when he talks about subjects of the kingdom, he's talking about those who grew up hearing about the promises of God. They know about how God worked in history. And then when God shows up, Israel's leaders are the ones being kicked out because they weren't allowing God to be God. The second thing I want you to see in this story is that Matthew says, this is not just a trickle of people coming in from outside. This is a multitude. Matthew says there's a stream or many. There's a crowd of people rushing into the city of God to celebrate God. And God's kingdom is open to them. And notice they come, Matthew says, from the east and the west. You know what the west was? The west was Roman Empire. The east was Babylon. In the Gospel of Luke, when this story is told, Jesus also says they're coming from the north and the south. South was Egypt. North was Assyria. These are Israel's enemies, the people they don't normally like. And now they're rushing in to the new kingdom of God. But think about the centurion. Think about what kind of stuff he had to leave at the gate. Because the centurion grew up thinking that, you know what matters is status and power and might. And this guy who grew up thinking that his rank was what defined him is now bowing his knee at a poor Jewish carpenter. And Jesus is radically accepting of him. Because God will let you into heaven. But listen, all of us are going to have to leave some significant things at the gate. God will let us into heaven, but not a single one of us will be able to carry our idols with us. Maybe for you it's your money. Maybe your money is your God, or your kids, or your spouse, or your career, or your religion, or your grudges. God will let us into heaven, but we will have to leave significant things at the gate. We'll talk about this more in a couple of weeks, but did you know that in the Christian tradition, there is no real distinction between the light of God or the glory of God and the fire of hell? Because when we stand before the unrestrained fullness of God, the one in whose image we have been made, we will all see how we have fallen short of who we were made to be. And I don't need to explain that more for most of you. Because you feel this ache in your life already. Some of us deal with it differently. We feel it with shame or inadequacy or pride or despair or guilt or anxiety or loneliness or whatever. It's the way our souls are hungry for God. The great playwright Arthur Miller, who wrote the famous play Death of a Salesman, he deconverted from Christianity when he was middle-aged because he said, I was tired of feeling guilty. And then he realized that guilt, that sense of inadequacy didn't go away. But now that he had taken God out of the judgment seat, what he did was he replaced the audience's approval for a way to justify his existence, to say that his life mattered. That's what I mean. We all need somebody. We're all looking for somebody to look at our lives and declare, not guilty, your life matters. But when we kick God out of the courtroom, we just replace him with some other judge. But there's no other judge who has the willingness or authority to accept and forgive you. There's not enough trophies you can win, even though we will try. There's not enough books you can read or books you can write. There's not enough kids you can have, not enough money you can make to justify your existence because the good does not cancel out the bad. And if you doubt that statement's truth, ask some of the people who your bad has hurt. Ask them if they would forgive the divorce because you got your graduate degree. Ask some of the people who you've hurt. Martin Luther, the great gospel preacher, said, the voice of condemnation is loud in all of our hearts. Satan has a lot to work with. We are guilty. But God speaks with a louder voice in the gospel. I have taken your sin. And when those moments of condemnation come, and they surely will, where shame hovers over you and you feel like you are finished, remember, on the cross, Jesus says, no, it is finished. When you are baptized, it's not magic water. It's that you're admitting to yourself, you're admitting to your friends and family and the world around you, you have come to the end of yourself. Baptism is not so much a choice or a decision as it is a moment of surrender. A moment of surrendering, I can't do this. When you're surrendering your freedom, your autonomy, your life, and your soul to the one who made you, who sustains you, who can transform you, and who will raise you. A couple weeks ago, I read about one of the most bizarre cases in the U.S. Supreme Court history. This is a true case. The defendant in 1833, a guy named George Wilson, pled guilty to acts of robbery and endangering the life of a male servant. A mailman. And because he did that, that was apparently a punishable cause by death. I'm not saying that right. He could be killed. He was going to be hanged for what he did. And he pled guilty. But President Andrew Jackson issued a full pardon. Here's where it gets weird. For reasons that we don't know, George Wilson refused it. And so that case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, who's looking at this guy who could either walk away free or be hanged, but was not accepting the pardon. And in 1833, this odd case, the Supreme Court said, a pardon is an act of grace, and that is a deed, the validity of which is delivery is essential, and delivery is not complete unless it is accepted. The Supreme Court said it may then be rejected, and if it be rejected, we have discovered no power in court to force it on him. And George Wilson was hanged because he would not accept the pardon that was there. The good news of hell is that God is going to say to everyone who causes harm, who causes tears and causes suffering, not here, you won't. But the good news of hell is that God also wants to make each one of us into the kind of person who fits in the age to come. And that world is starting now. For every person who is baptized, the language of the New Testament is, you become a new creation. God begins his new creation work in you. And in some mysterious way, we become a part of the creation to come. Listen, if you struggle with despair or anxiety or guilt or shame, baptism is not magic. But it is mystical. You receive a help. You receive a comforter, a transformer who gives you a new life, Jesus' life. You make the choice that makes all other choices and shapes the trajectory of not just this life, but your eternal one. If you're watching and you've never been baptized, or if you're here and you would like to be baptized, would you come talk to me? And if you're watching, you can text PV Next Step to 94090. Because if anyone goes to hell, it will be over Jesus' dead and risen body.